This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
There's a bedtime story about the Goldberg variations. It might or might not be true, but I'm going to tell it to you anyway. Once upon a time, a young music student named Johann Gottlieb Goldberg and a certain Count Kaiserling came to Dresden. The Count was often ill and had sleepless nights, and at such times, Goldberg had to spend the night in an antechamber so as to play for him during his insomnia. Once the Count mentioned in Bach's presence that he would like to have some clavier pieces for Goldberg, which should be of such a smooth and somewhat lively character that he might be a little cheered up by them in his sleepless nights. And so the story goes on, Bach set to work. We can imagine the Count, shorn of his powdered wig and his white makeup, lying in his bed. We can imagine Goldberg, who was then a boy of 14, still wearing his, still on duty, tinkling away. And although we have no idea where that chamber and that antechamber were, there are enough of them still around to enable us to imagine what they looked like. The Count's bed is too short to lie down in, and it's so high that it's necessary to use steps to climb into it. The Count's head is a portrait framed by an elaborate headboard, crimson curtains that wouldn't be out of place in an opera house, and the sort of canopy you'd expect to find over an altar. The bed is a shrine set behind a gilded rail, attended by plaster cherubs, frothy clouds, and buxom Olympian gods. No wonder the Count couldn't get to sleep. It's a scene so sweet, so rich, that it could be moulded in marzipan and coated in chocolate, or cast in imitation Meissen porcelain, sold on special offer in the pages of the Sunday colour supplements, and put on a mantelpiece to join all those little busts of the composers in their preposterous wigs. Bach's curmudgeonly judge, Haydn's urbane barrister, Lully's glam rock baroque peruke, and all the rest of them. It's the sort of kitsch normally reserved only for Liberace fans, dictators, Vegas casinos, and the breakfast rooms of B&Bs. My tasteful home, and I suspect yours, are built on principles of quite a different spirit. In his Manual of the Dwelling of 1923, that prophet of modern architecture, Le Corbusier, laid them down in no uncertain terms. "Demand bare walls in your bedroom," he preached, "your living room and your dining room. Buy only practical furniture and never buy decorative pieces. If you want to see bad taste, go into the houses of the rich. Take a flat which is one size smaller than what your parents accustomed you to. Bear in mind economy in your actions, your household management, and in your thoughts." The economy Corbusier was talking about wasn't just a matter of appearances. All those modern clichés, form follows function, ornament is crime, truth to materials, relate aesthetics to ethics and the social order that supports them. If it's hard for us moderns to approve of Count Kaiserling's domestic arrangements, it's not just because the decor was in poor taste. Set the scene today, and one can imagine the social services getting in touch about Goldberg's working hours and his age before he'd started playing Variation Number 2. Interior decor, architecture, and the social relations they house are intimately connected. Baroque palaces, for example, didn't have corridors. Instead, room led to room, antechamber to chamber, each one a waiting room for the next, each more richly decorated than the last. Entry to each dependent on favour with the prince, who lay enthroned in his monstrous bed at the end of the enfilade. The Baroque bedroom wasn't a place to curl up under the duvet. It was at the pinnacle of the social and political hierarchy. And at the pinnacle of all those bedrooms was that of Louis XIV at Versailles. It took the Sun King more than 2 hours to rise from his bed every morning. He was woken through the curtains by his valet at 7:15, examined by the royal surgeon at 7:30, and sat up in bed to be greeted by all the grandees of the French court at 8:15. At 8:30, the keeper of his wigs would present him with his first of the day, and he would shave in a mirror held before him by a page boy. At 9, the crown prince would step forward to hand his father the royal vest, and half an hour later, fully dressed, the king would replace his first wig of the day with another, fuller, curlier, higher, made from the hair of the peasants of Arras and Lille. At 10, he would leave his bedroom in procession, followed by hundreds of courtiers. "L'État, c'est moi," he was famously quoted as saying, "I am the state," and every morning, as the Sun King rose, it must have seemed like he was. But no one was ever really convinced, not even at the time. Over the Channel in England, Hogarth published a print of the Five Orders of Whig that parodied the get-up of the Frenchified dandies of his day, and Alexander Pope laughed at the trees cut like statues and the statues thick as trees of the Baroque landscapes of Versailles. John Bull's Common Sense was born in opposition to the manifest absurdity of our continental neighbours. That's why we still value it. The truth was that Versailles was a fantasy. The truth was that rulers like Louis XIV were less powerful than most democratically elected leaders today, and his palace was produced in an age where the authority of the crown, religion, and indeed the very concept of authority was under threat. Like most totalitarian propaganda, Versailles was a camp, slightly desperate performance. It certainly started with one. The Pleasures of the Enchanted Island, it was called. The king dressed up as a medieval knight, the guests ate castles made of marzipan, and the festivities ended with the destruction of a magical palace in a spectacular firework display. They started building the real one as soon as they'd dismantled the charred remains of the scenery. They were still building 50 years later. The place was by then nearly a kilometre long and housed 14,000 people, but they all knew that it wasn't really a palace. When the Baroque Ancien Régime finally came to an end in the French Revolution, the aristocratic inhabitants of Versailles made their escape disguised as peasants and servants in fancy dress outfits they'd had made up for the latest garden party. The modernist city, believe it or not, was born in much the same spirit. In 1933, the International Congress of Modern Architecture launched a charter for the modern city. The machinist civilization is moving in amid disorder, improvisation, and ruins, they said. But in the hands of the authorities, itemized, annotated, clarified with an adequate explanation, their charter was, they claimed, the implement by which the destiny of cities will be set right. And they proceeded to describe the city of the future in exhaustive detail, from the zoning of different functions to the width of the dual carriageways and the design of the handrails on the balconies. The Radiant City, Corbusier called it, and it was a fantasy whose improbable order was not so different from that of Versailles. No one really believed it would happen. But we've all been there. We know what the Radiant City of the future looks like because they built it in the end, in housing estates and new towns from Dresden to Drumchapel. Enchanted islands of pleasure, they are not. It's hard to feel radiantly optimistic if you're in post-industrial Glasgow watching the wrecks of the 60s housing schemes come tumbling down. The city of modern architecture was discredited a long time ago now, and it often feels as if its only legacy is economy in another sense of the word. The god of the contemporary bien-pensant is a god of small things, of allotments and the recycling bin, repair and refurbishment, the microblog rather than the epic, community rather than society. We gaze upon the iconic shards and gherkins and armadillos produced by today's starchitects, the great Jubilympic mask, the power ballad, or the Hollywood blockbuster, and find it hard to admire their bombast. We certainly don't believe it'll turn us into better people. We're like those courtiers at Versailles, sniggering behind their hands in the Sun King's bedroom. Mired in a recessionary mindset, we have become sceptical of spectacle, and we no longer trust the grand utopian gesture. But we're in a time that needs one more than ever. We're in a fix, environmentally, economically, and we've got no idea about how to get out of it, other than tinkering recycling, bailouts, and technocracy, other than even more economy. It won't save us. There was something wrong with the Radiant City, we can all agree, but it isn't that it didn't work. No building, no city really ever works. Think of the chaos of London or Mumbai at rush hour. No one would characterize those cities as failures, however difficult they might be to live in. The problem lay elsewhere. Whether in manuals for the home or charters for the city, injunctions about form and function or truth and materials, the problem with modern architecture was that it was real. It wasn't good enough to dream about ideal societies. Rather, architects had to build them. And once they had, all their grand claims about architecture being able to set the destiny of cities aright and to perfect the human condition were saddled with the burden of proof. In order to work, modern architecture had to work perfectly. No wonder it is perceived to have failed. And that's where we return to Count Kaiserling, Sleepless in Dresden, as Bach's theme repeats itself in variations, like an enfilade of antechambers, each more criminally ornamented than the last. The Count is wearing a wig that no one would have thought was real, lying in a bed too grand for sleeping in a room surveyed by deities that no one had believed in for centuries. If there's a utopia here, it's a bad taste fake, rigged up in velvet and ormolu and woven out of powdered peasants' hair. Despite all their silly get-up, or no, actually because of it, those old Baroccas knew something we mods don't. In a Baroque palace, Elysium and all its attendant cherubs remain painted on ceilings, plastered to walls, and embroidered on beds. They invite us not to believe, but to suspend for a moment our disbelief, and to dream for a moment of an improbable world in which castles can be made of marzipan and hair is spun like candy floss. Unlike their modern counterparts, the utopians of the Baroque got to have their very considerable cakes and to eat them, to imagine ideal worlds without ever having to prove them true. Let me put it more simply. It's art, stupid. There's a moral here for our straitened times that, like the story of the Goldberg variations, might or might not be true. It's certainly not an economical plan. Sometimes truth can be rated too highly over hope. Sometimes ornament isn't a crime, but a way of stating what we wish for by draping images of it superficially over what is. Sometimes, perhaps, form shouldn't follow function, but fiction. We're not going to see our way out of the dark night we're in anytime soon. So, like Count Kaiserling, we might as well lie back, listen to music, imagine, and dream absurd dreams.
The essay was presented by Ed Hollis and produced